having been there, I can confirm it's an incredible space, and every dollar is put to lots of use. So we have some time for questions, and I don't think we have a microphone that will travel, so just ask.
We'll have one in 30 seconds.
Amazing, amazing. So just a couple of requests is that everyone keep their questions to one or two sentences, and it should end with a question mark. So if you have something that you want to share, that's great. Maybe after the Q&A you can approach Mazen or whoever else to share that, but this is a chance to ask questions. And yeah, that's about it. So,
Sorry. Do we have a
All right, so.
You do the others, yes?
While I equalize the mic.
All right. Should I wait?
Go ahead.
Okay, does anyone have a question?
So, if I take a conclusion, I would imagine that what you're thinking of a political solution is essentially a one state, secular, kind of a secular state where everybody is equal. Do I have it right?
I mean, I think the issues in Palestine are issues of human rights. And if we focus on human rights, I'm not a nationalist personally. I don't care if it's one state, 10 states, 15 states. My point is more about inclusivity and human rights. And so, yes, of course, if you think about it logically, what does it mean to have diversity? Is you cannot have a Jewish state or a Muslim state or a Christian state. You have a state. State of its citizens. You take the notions of nationalism and its ethnocentric, chauvinistic structure to citizenship and equality.
Thank you, Dr. Kunsi, for that wonderful talk and the work that you do there. And I'm one of the lucky people who actually got a chance to visit the museum. You had mentioned about being able to fund the museum through several grants, external, international, I'm assuming. What kind of, what are the donating agencies that you've been able to work with, and what are the stipulations on those grants and donations that sometimes come or sometimes even force you to potentially rethink taking that money?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this. Actually, the first 2 years we had zero donations from anybody, except me and my wife, who donated $250,000 for the infrastructure to get it going. So we had our own money, which we invested, and we had the volunteers, so we worked with volunteers. As we grew after the first two preparatory years, We wanted to hire people, and we wanted to bring more volunteers, and we wanted more infrastructure and more works, and we needed more money. So we started to ask for individual donations, etc. And in 2015, I think I got a few individual donations, including from friends and relatives, and there's a couple of people here, I think, also who donated. And 2016 more, and then 2017 more individual donations. We started to apply for what they call foundation grants, which are specific for certain projects, only about a year and a half or 2 years ago. And I was presently surprised that actually we were getting some of this. And by the way, the reason I'm here in America now is because we got a National Geographic grant, which is amazing. The first grant for Palestinians. And I met actually with the president and CEO of National Geographic. This is a huge organization, billions of dollars that they spend every other year. And they gave us a grant. It's not a big grant. It's $29,000. But it was very important and symbolic that for the first time they give a Palestinian institution, a grant from National Geographic. And not only that, I have this annual National Geographic Conference in Washington, D.C., so we applied to go there, and they accepted us. I didn't pay for the trip, hence the donation. By the way, some of them will pay for the trip. But it was very important because the people there from over, like, there were 300 people from over 110 countries. And most of them have never heard of Palestine or environmental issues in Palestine or any of this stuff. Not only that, even when I registered for the National Geographic to go to the conference, they didn't have Palestine listed on their web. Scrolled down, looked under Palestine, not there. Looked under O for Occupied Palestinian Territory, not there. I looked under W for the West Bank and Gaza, it's not there. So I didn't know what to put. I had the institution up there at Bethlehem University. I ended up selecting United States of America. So Bethlehem University is now in the U.S. But I had to register, and then I'm still negotiating, and I started drafting the letter to the president about this oversight on their part. But anyways, hopefully it will grow, and people become familiar and support us and so forth. The problem with these foundation grants is, I think, the kind of between the lines of what you said, I kind of figure out maybe that's what you want to ask, is the issue that they are giving you grant for a specific thing, for something that they are interested in. And I certainly, there are plenty of grants I could get if I want to compromise any of our principles, which I don't. As I told you, even with the American consulate, I wrote, this is for resistance. And that we're teaching children to love Palestine as the mother country. Anyway, I get calls from Israelis and emails, for example, telling me there's the German trilateral something or another that supports collaboration between German, Israeli, and Palestinian scientists. And we have 200,000 euros. If you want them, we can give them to you. And I say, sorry, I don't cooperate with Israelis. We obey the BDS rules. So if I want to compromise our principles, I can. But I found out that you can do a lot. You can, you know, as I tell my students, you know, when you put your mind to it, you can do anything you want. I mean, I'm not allowed to Jerusalem, by the way. Next week I'm going to go to Jerusalem. I'm not allowed into Jerusalem, even with my American passport. But I violate Israeli law. Heck with them, you know. They prevent us from having, like, you work in molecular biology and things like that. 100% alcohol, we're not allowed to have. Formaldehyde, we're not allowed to have. How are you going to preserve specimens or do pathology in a hospital? And my background is also in genetics and things like that. If you don't have formaldehyde, well, what do? You give up? You throw your hands in the air? No. Or you collaborate with Israelis? No. What you do is you resist and smuggle it. And if any of you is coming to Palestine, I have a list of things you can bring me with you.
This might be a very naive question, but why would you want the cooperation of Israeli scientists? Why would you work together and try to build something with that?
Let me be very clear. It's not that I don't talk or cooperate with Israeli scientists. We do. As a scientist, you know, of course, I have to read their literature. They read my literature. We exchange emails. We correspond. We discuss scientific methods. But we cannot collaborate officially. For example, I cannot publish a paper with an Israeli scientist. That would be normalization under occupation. Because their institutions are complicit with the occupation. And I cannot ask an Israeli scientist, of course, who is just on a friendly basis to bring me some formaldehyde with him. Because then he said, well, if you publish a paper, I want my name on it or something. No, I'm sorry. You know, I have others who can smuggle, including Israelis, by the way. Israeli Jews who or not part of the establishment, so to speak. And we have many of those. In fact, when I was arrested, and I was arrested over 15 times, half the times I was arrested with Israelis. So that's collaboration. We cooperate. We cooperate in a joint struggle, but we cannot cooperate officially on a scientific subject, or even if it's environmental, even if it's benign, we cannot do it.
Have you contacted the Union of Concerned Scientists here who work a lot against climate change, or other environmental groups like 350 NAS, Bill McKibben?
I haven't contacted the Union of Concerned Scientists, but I'll make a note to do that. That's one thing, actually, that you guys can help us with. I really appreciate that you're donating, but that's not the major thing I would like you to help us with. The main thing I would like you to help us with is networking us with people who can help, who can support us. Our biggest shortage, actually, is human resources. Resources of people who know about certain things, who can teach our students about certain things like aquaponics, aquaculture, permaculture, biodiversity conservation, management plans for protected areas, things like that. And also even simple things like technology, computers, how to use social media, how to whatever, how to reach out to an audience, media work, for example, making films. So we could use a lot of technical support, which is what we call donation in kind, if you want. It's not donation of money. And that certainly, any of you, for example, you just mentioned one group, Union Concerned Scientists, but you can, if you, any of you think of other groups we should be contacting, just email me. By the way, my card is in the back next on the table with the books, so feel free to take a card so that you can email me. But if you put your email on the sign-up sheet, you should hear from me. And those of you who are on the email list know that you do hear from me. I send a message every week, and I'm not shy.
I wanted to see a show of hands of how many people here are involved in the environmental movements or in the sciences. Maybe you could stand up just so we get a sense. Who is in the room that is working in the sciences or in the environmental justice movements?
I heard locally.
There are
a lot of
great. But again, it doesn't have to be in environmental. It can be in media work, or it can be in social movement, or it can be, computer science, arts. You know, Deb Van Poolen, for example, was an artist. She came to Palestine, volunteered with us, painted beautiful murals on our rooms, on the animal room, etc. Exhibit areas, how to make exhibits. You can do many, many things. So the third thing you can do is come and volunteer, as Annabelle did. And we welcome volunteers of all ages and all capabilities. We had a 92-year-old volunteer one time, so... and we had a 10-year-old volunteers and 8-year-old volunteers. So, well, I mean, obviously they don't like me. I don't know why. I'm a likable person. But one time we were collecting scorpions at night and with UV lights in the middle of the desert. And suddenly I was just focused on the ground because scorpions fluoresce with the UV light. So I wasn't paying attention. There were two other young people with me. And suddenly we see these floodlights from... And shouting at us in Hebrew to the effect of lift your hands up or we're going to shoot you or something. It's not easy. Most areas of the West Bank that are nature reserve or protected areas, we don't have access to, according to Israeli military orders. But again, it doesn't mean I don't go in there and do my studies and my work. So it's not very easy, but it is doable. Sometimes, actually, they are surprised. It varies soldier by soldier. Some soldiers are like, wow, there are Palestinians who actually study nature. It's like, you know, all Palestinians must be terrorists by nature, you know? So they are surprised, and they are, like, very nice, and let us go. We try our best. I mean, sometimes importing things is a big thing, and people send us donations from abroad, like books. One time somebody, like, had, like, 50 books that they shipped to us, and I sat at the dock in Tel Aviv, and I received this letter that says I have to pay $900. I said, 50 books are not worth $900. Go ahead, take them. I'm not going to bother with it, you know. So that's harassment, I think. When it says used books and it's donation to a university, why do they have to hold them? Why do they have to put exorbitant fees on them and stuff like that? So we refused to pay that. And I told them to either ship them back or take them. I don't even know what they did with them.
My question is, your hypothesis is that diversity brings strength. And as a practical matter, I personally think that the strength needs to go to the Palestinian people. And so my question is, are you reaching out, and what is your program to bring your philosophy to your people? Mm-hmm. In your museum or...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what we do. I mean, just last year, 3,000 students went through the museum. We don't just have them come and say, wow, you know, stuffed animal. That's not what we do with them. We work with them one-on-one, practically, by hand, by talking, by coaching, by creating an environment where these kids feel empowered, feel strength. And this changes them, and it creates a ripple effect in society. I'll just tell you one story about this that's kind of funny that happened. You know, my office is at the end of the hall in the corridor there. And one day I was sitting at my desk working on my computer peacefully when I heard this very loud noise. Where is Professor Kumsi? And I'm like, oh, what is this? So I stuck my head out and I said, this way, you know, he walks down. Are you Professor Kumsi? I said, yes. Sit down. What can I help you with? He sat down and he says, what did you do to my daughter? I'm like, oh, shit. What did I do to your daughter? I don't know. Who's your daughter? What is this about? He says, well, she came here with her classmates a couple of weeks ago, and she came back and she was like this revolutionary nut. She is telling me I am not supposed to smoke and I'm not supposed to throw organic waste in the garbage, and she wants everything clean around the house. And I said, so you're angry about that? He said, no, I'm not angry. I came to thank you. I said, well, the tone of your voice scared the shit out of me. But you see, that's ripple effect, is people go out and they make changes. My students, like the student I showed you, Muhammad Abu Sarhan, came to us, I mean, when he was a high school student. And then I took him in as a biology student at our university. I told him, he published his first paper when he was a freshman. His English was very poor. Quickly, he just grew, and because he was talking to, like, some internationals who are at the museum, so he strengthened his English, and he started reading when I told him the importance of reading, and one thing led to another. I mean, the guy is a genius, actually. If he if he finishes master's and PhD and if no Italian girl kidnaps him, he will come back and be the director of this museum. I'm, by the way, I'm an interim volunteer director. I'm not, my wife and I are volunteers 7 days a week, and we don't take a penny. So it is, you know, I need somebody eventually to take on and become a director. And I think there is a possibility that this would be the person.
Thank you very much for the talk. I don't know if you still remember me. I just want to say something about Dr.
Maybe Mason. People should say their names when they ask questions. Sorry, but...
So I have witnessed Dr. Comsilla doing something else that you guys might not know. He actually introduced the cytogenetics tools to diagnose Palestinian patients with blood cancer. And I was honored really to work with him on that when he was in Bethlehem University. I don't know if you guys are going to do the same thing, yeah. But this is something in addition to the resistance to the biodiversity studies that Dr. Fonsia introduced. And I have a question actually to you. Have you guys done studies on the effect of the separation wall on the biodiversity, which I would imagine would be very influential, especially with the cutting the continuity of the land between, you know, the West and the East side of the separation wall?
Actually, this is a study we did. If anybody is interested, you can have it. It's Actions for Environmental Sustainability in Wadi Zarqa. This was funded by UNDP, actually, and we looked in Wadi Zarqa at the effect of the wall on the biodiversity of this area, which is a beautiful protected area with lots of things that are there that are endangered. And yes, we do studies like this. There needs to be a lot more studies. And again, if you were to ask me what's your biggest shortage, it's not supplies, it's not money, it's people. So if we have people who are interested, from here or from there or wherever, who will come and work with us, we can do a lot. In the cytogenetics area that you mentioned, for example, I even created the jobs in Palestine that were not there before. For example, Reem, who now works full-time in the lab, she gets her salary from the U.S. The lab in New Jersey sends us the pictures of the chromosomes. She analyzes them, sends them the results back, and they pay her salary. So this is like outsourcing, so it's creating a job in Palestine. But it takes time to train these people and to develop them and to supervise them and all of this stuff. And I tell you, you know, for me personally, my biggest shortage is time, you know, my own time, but... So the more people involved, the more we can do, and so human capacity is the biggest shortage we have.
Are you trying to have like exchange programs with Robbie?
Are you trying to start some exchange programs with from the American and European universities?
Yeah, we do actually have internships open, and we have we received, for example, the paper on the decline in vertebrate biodiversity in Bethlehem region that we studied, like the effect of the settlements. That was done with Sibel Zabala, who is a German student interned with us. And now I have two German students actually with us interning. We have an exchange program with Italy, which is the reason my student Mohammed is now in Italy. I went to Italy and spoke at their universities, lectured their students. I got some faculty from Italy who came and lectured with our students. And we have student-student exchange also. So now we have 9 Palestinian students in this Italian university who are doing programs. I think this summer we're supposed to get the Italian students to come spend time with us. There's a lot of potential in that, but people need to apply to them. For example, I know in the U.S. there's a Fulbright program, and people should apply to that, and we should say, but again, I need people who will take the lead and do these things, because there is resources available. It's just a matter of finding the people who would write and fill out the forms and all of this stuff. I am optimistic as time goes by and we become more institutionalized, this will be kind of like accelerating like a snowball effect.
Not able to build things that are, you know, solar programs that are put up are destroyed. Everything that's built is destroyed there. And that's what, people are attacked. But there are people who come, and when somebody came from the ISM, we used to have a very active ISM program. Of students. Now, money goes, but people don't go. Americans don't go anymore. Or they go in much smaller amounts. No. And I'm wondering, because Gaza is so treacherous today, and it seems that Palestinians are taking all of the brunt of it, but their institutions and their program, everything they built, are destroyed. That's what
I mean. Of course, we have challenges, including the fact that Israel occasionally destroys what we built. I mean, there is Europeans who donate to build schools for the Bedouins and solar powers for the Bedouin, and Israel came and destroyed them. That happens, and I don't want to make it look like a rosy scenario where it's easy to do everything. You know, actually, the difficulties make the challenge interesting. And if it was all easy, you know, maybe it's not worth it. So the challenge is important, and we are challenged, I admit, and it's not easy. As far as number of internationals coming to Palestine, I would disagree with you, actually. I've seen an increase year after year after year, even with Israel denying entry to people. I had 7 people who were denied entry to come and help us in the museum, to volunteer at the museum. Either as I discovered that they were coming to volunteer at the museum, that they are not really tourists and things like that, one of them slipped and mentioned my name, and immediately they put him on the next airplane back. So I think there are challenges, but I really believe that when there is a will, there is a way. Israel even now says, anybody here, any one of you who supported the BDS movement is automatically denied entry at the border. This is like a law now in Israel. Well, I'm sorry, everybody here is probably supporting the BDS. But Midia Benjamin went there after a law was introduced, and she managed to get through. I don't know how. So people do manage, you know, to get in. Some people take new passports. Some people, you know, you get a new number when you get a new passport or something. So there's always a way to get around these things. And I encourage people, don't give up on trying to do something positive. But even, let's say, okay, you know, they destroy this, they destroy that, but there's still, you know, a lot of things we can do. Electronically we can do things. We can write. They can't stop us from writing. We can publish, we can communicate, we can give lectures. And many times when they denied me going to certain places, I give lectures by Skype. So... You know, they can't stop the internet. I think Zionism really needs to understand that they have lost. Sorry, but they have lost past tense. Not really. It's just a matter for us to convince them that they have lost. So I, if we think as winners, we will be winners. If we think as losers and we throw our hands up in the air, this is what we call mental occupation. I wrote an article. If any of you is interested in this, I have a book coming out from Routledge called Postcolonial History. And I have a chapter on mental colonization in that book. If anybody is interested in this chapter, I can send it to you as a PDF. You can read it. It's amazing that mental colonization is actually more dangerous than physical occupation, more dangerous than any destruction they can do to us. If they convince us that there's no hope, then definitely we will have no hope. If we think as free, then we're free. There's a story about that. I told it in Connecticut, by the way. One time they took me in this dungeon, basically underground, a hole in the ground, basically, and there's no bathroom, and there were 15 of us. There was actually Basil Larej, the one I showed you a picture of, with the T-shirt that says Boycott Divestment Sanctions, and his aunt, actually, Shireen, was there. And we were in this hole, and there's no bathrooms, and it stinks, the place stinks, because it's underground, no ventilation. And there's a soldier up there, and there's a fence around this hole, this ditch, basically. There's a soldier there with a gun. And I'm sitting and talking to these young people, and the soldier says, stop talking, like that. And then I kept talking, they kept talking, then he cocked his gun, pointed at me, and said, stop talking. And so the young people were afraid. I wasn't afraid, but, you know, I didn't want to jeopardize them. So I started singing and dancing. And he looked at me like, didn't I tell you stop talking? I said, yeah, but you didn't say stop singing and dancing. So he was like, look, and the kids couldn't help it but laugh, you know. And even him, I noticed a little smile on the side. So then I said, listen, if you don't want me to talk to these people, can I just come and talk to you for just 2 minutes? That's all I need of your time, is just 2 minutes, and then I'll do whatever you want me to do. He said, what do you want to say to me? So I walk up the steps halfway. I didn't want to threaten him or anything. And I said to him, you know what? You speak good English, so let me just say to you, you know, what I really think. Part of the reason I'm talking or dancing or singing is take my mind off going to the bathroom, because I'm not going to go in the bathroom in the corner there, especially with the lady in the house and these young people. And I'm a professor at the university and things like that. I teach biology and stuff like that. But that's not really what I want to tell you. I want to tell you something more important. He said, what? I said, I'm more free than you are. He said, what? I said, I'm more free than you are. I came here by my choice. I knew exactly that I would end up here. I went to this demonstration in Al-Walaja, and we were standing in front of the bulldozers, and I knew I would end up here because this is not the first time I end up here. And I know you guys will keep us here for torture for 2 or 3 hours until the investigator decides on his whim whether to sit with us and ask us a question, interrogate us or not. But you're not free. You cannot, you know, he said, no, I'm free, I can do whatever. I said, well, can you take off this uniform, go with me across the street, we can have a cup of coffee and relax a little bit. He said, no, well, I have to guard you with terrorists. I said, see, you proved my point. And this conversation went on for an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and a half, and then this soldier, we talked about everything, religion, culture, Zionism, everything. And eventually the same soldier went to his commander and demanded that they let us to the bathroom. They let us, because at first he said, I will go to the commander and ask him to let you to go to the bathroom. I said, no, you don't understand. I don't go by myself. You know, these people need to go too. So they had us go. And the only bathroom they had is the one for the officers. And the soldiers, you know, so the soldiers were looking like, you're bringing these terrorists into the compound, to our bathroom? Said, well, go ask the commander. He allowed it. So, you know, this is, to me, is mental freedom, you know. Physical freedom is nothing. Walls and settlements and occupation and killings and all of this is nothing compared to mental occupation. Stephen Biko, I think, said the same thing, that the best weapon in the hand of the occupier is the mind of the occupied. And in the civil rights movement, they used to say, free your mind and your ass will follow.